Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Yo, 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 this is Eddie Schumard coming to you live from the Heritage Radio Network studios at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. You're listening to a special community session. I got Joe Galarraga engineering today's show. And with me in the studios today is Emily Peterson, award-winning food writer, culinary teacher, food grower, gardener, TV personality, culinary educator at the Astor Center, and founder of the website The Gourmand and the Peasant. Impressive. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So first off, give us a little background. How did you get all of those slashes in your title?
It all sounds very impressive in hindsight. When I was a kid, my parents were incredible cooks. And as soon as I could see over the stove, I was allowed to start making my own French toast. And so, but it was always something extracurricular. So I was going to college and working in a restaurant. I graduated and I got a real job at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden running the helping to run the public events department. But I would go and bartend four nights a week and like work until 4 a.m. and then be up at work the next morning. And so it was always something I was doing on the side. And then I started working with a wine importer. So I started getting into the wine world, and that was super exciting. And then the Botanic Garden job just wasn't exciting anymore. It wasn't fulfilling anymore. And so I decided to join the New York City Teaching Fellows. And I got my master's degree in teaching, and I taught math in Bed-Stuy in middle school for 3 years. And the kids were amazing, and the grown-ups were insane. And so,
it's always the case. Like, kids, awesome.
The parents, kids were great. Everyone's like, oh, how'd you deal with those kids? I'm like, the kids were awesome. Right. The parents and the, you know. So I decided to take a job as an educational technology sort of guru, and I taught teachers how to use smart boards and iPods and things in their curriculum. And as that career got more, you know, as I sort of rose very slowly and even just a little bit, I got stuck behind a desk. And I took a job at a university that was a 3-hour commute away, making more money than I'd ever seen. But I had 3 hours in one direction and 3 hours back, and the man that I shared my cubicle with said, "You realize you're flying to Germany every day."
Said, that's a good way to put that.
Yeah. And I just wasn't passionate about the job, and I had a lot of time on my hands. So I started thinking about how I could, like, you know, do something different. And I didn't know at the time, but I was feeling very entrepreneurial, and I was cooking the whole time. So I was throwing big dinner parties, big birthday parties, you know, cooking for friends' parties. And I was like, I'm going to open a yoga studio. My husband was like,
I'm cooking a lot. Yoga.
And yes. He was like, you smoke, which I don't anymore. But at the time I was like, well, yeah, I guess that would look kind of bad. And I really love meat. And so I couldn't like pursue a vegetarian lifestyle. So I was like, okay, I'm going to open a knitting studio. He was like, it took you 4 years to make my scarf. I was like, well, I could teach other people. Like, I know I'm a good teacher. And, you know, as my job that I had, I was getting more and more unhappy and more depressed. And I had this, like, real existential, like, actual depression that I fell into. And one night, I had come home from my 3-hour commute. My husband was already asleep. And I decided to make chicken stock at, like, 9 o'clock. And I was standing at the counter sobbing, slicing a carrot, which I've done since I was probably 5 or 6 years old. My father let me use the chef knife.
Slicing the carrots or the sobbing while slicing?
Just the slicing part. No, okay, the sobbing. It was like the first time I was crying at the same time that I was cooking. And because my dad let me use his chef's knives from a very young age. And now that I have my own child, I think, when am I going to let you pick that up?
Right.
But anyway, I was standing at the counter and I was slicing this carrot, and I just had this like epiphany moment. I'd spent so much time trying to figure out what I wanted to be and who I wanted to, you know, be when I grew up. And I was like, cook, like go to culinary school. And I still get chills when I like think about that moment, because I had a wonderful therapist who was like, when you know, you're gonna just know. And I was like,
Right. Don't ever say that again.
Please don't say that, because it's so, you know, and then it's exactly what happened. And I call it my Oprah moment, which is, you know, do what you love. Just, like, follow your passion.
Right.
So I quit my job within a week of that, and I enrolled in the Institute of Culinary Education in Manhattan with no plans, knowing that I wasn't going to be a, like, restaurant chef right out of culinary school. I was almost 30, and I just was like, I'm going to figure out another way to make money and make this work. And I loved culinary school. I wish I could just keep going back. Like, I just want to keep starting over from the beginning. It's like summer camp. Like, can I just go back to the beginning and do it all over again? But they wouldn't let me. So I had to graduate. And while I was there, I also got the culinary management business sort of part of the program. And I learned that you have to work in a restaurant for a year for anyone to take you seriously. So I went on a couple of trails at places that were not my people, and I was like a chaperone. I was so old in the kitchen. And then I went to the Green Table, and I walked in, which is in a restaurant in Chelsea Market owned by the venerable Mary Cleaver. And I walked into the back, and it was like my people.
You're
like,
home.
I was instantly at home. So I started working there on the line a couple nights a week and in the catering a couple of days a week. And I just loved it. It was like, again, it was like going to camp every day. I was like, this is so much fun. Sure, I got 500
But the whole time you were like,
sure.
you're still like, this is just a means to the end of getting into this teaching.
I didn't know.
Now
I was just sort of like putting one foot in front of the other. Now I was like along for the ride. I was like, okay, I've like jumped into the right, I'm finally in the right current. Let's just see where this kind of goes. And that's sort of the story of my life from that point forward. So I was working for Mary, and I was working on the line, and it's, you know, the problem with working in a restaurant is that when you really love to go out and eat, everyone else is like asleep because you're, right. You know, you want to go out to eat at 4 a.m. when you've got, just gotten off your shift. And so I did it for a year. I earned my like military stripe on my shoulder patch. And then I moved out to New Jersey, and I went to an interview at the Astor Center. They were hiring a teacher to come and teach classes. And prior to enrolling in culinary school, I had seen an ad in Time Out New York to tour the Green Market and learn how to cook with a chef. And I was like, I could teach that. Like, what? And I was so resentful. Like, I want to do that. And then all of a sudden, I had this interview. So I, like, tried so hard, and I wore my, like, power suit, which was
nice.
A terrible idea. Like, I didn't know I because that's what you do when you want to impress. And it was like 105 degrees in
not
August.
Nice, yeah.
I arrived looking like I'd fallen off a boat, but you know, the Kimberly, who you will meet, everyone will meet at the event, she interviewed me and she gave me the job. And so I took this background in teaching, which I love to do. Being the boss of stuff, which I also love to do, and cooking, and I ended up developing about a dozen classes that were super popular and sold out all the time. It was hands-on, and the lobster class was written up in the Robb Report, which I later learned was a magazine for the incredibly wealthy to figure out ways to spend money on hobbies. So if you Google Robb Report, you see.
So before you go, like, some of the listeners who might not be familiar with the Astor Center, give us a little bit of background on what the Astor Center does.
Sure. So it's a recreational kitchen teaching program. Like, you wouldn't go there. There's not classes every day. It's primarily focused on wine and spirits. So you can take a class on how to distinguish whiskey from bourbon, or garden cocktails.
I would just feign ignorance the whole time I was in that class. But I still don't get it. I need more.
Can I have a little? And luckily, you're in a room with 30 other people who are doing exactly the same thing, and 6 people who are pouring whiskey who are like, absolutely. My husband and I went to an absinthe tasting class. I don't remember the second 2/3 of it. I mean, here are these 6 absinthe, and we're like, great.
Yeah, you're like, one was enough.
One was plenty, but we had to try those other 5. Savoir Magazine, I think, called it the culinary center of New York City. So it's a really fun place to have a wedding, and lots of companies come there and throw a private event. So if you work at Google and you're looking for something fun to do with your team, they come there and I'll set up how to build a sliders and grill your own. And so it's a really, really fun place. And
that's exciting.
I absolutely love it. And they are like my second family.
So I read that you grew up on a farm in Long Island. How did that influence you in both teaching and in the culinary world, like that experiential learning that you do on a farm and in gardens? Like, and it sounds like even in your teaching career, there was that focus on learning through doing. And obviously at the Astor Center, that's exactly what you're doing. You know, how did that influence that early childhood experience? Like, you know, how did that influence you?
So when I say farm, I mean, we had a garden and chickens and rabbits and honeybees. And we had pet rabbits that we were allowed to name. And we had other rabbits that we were not allowed to name. But it wasn't a farm in the traditional sense of, like, there's no barn. And I will confess that it was in the Hamptons. So I was surrounded by extreme wealth. And I didn't realize, like, it gave me a very warped perspective on what my adult life was going to look like. That being said, you know, other kids were coming to school with Lunchables and, like, pre-made, you know, pre-packaged, like, hot dogs and things, and it just wasn't something that I was into. I was far more into, like, I wonder what would happen if I put, like, sugar into this, you know, salad dressing. And I just, from a very young age, I was encouraged by my parents, who, you know, I didn't have a lot of agency, like, in other things, like, you know, we didn't choose family vacations as a group. It was, like, very dictatorial in that way, but for some reason, cooking was... my parents would let me cook dinner, and if the steamed vegetables were done and we ate them and then an hour later the baked potato came out, that was totally fine. Like, they never even made a point of being like... Later on, they were like, you know, we should try to bring them at least a little closer together. But it was never like... So I just had a really fun sort of culinary playground where I wasn't judged. You know, my parents never yelled at me, and, you know, if I didn't do the dishes, that was sort of like, that was a no-no. I was going to get yelled at for that. But I got to just sort of explore. And that's how I teach people, because, you know, I can tell you how to make a perfect grilled cheese sandwich. I could say, step one, step two, step three, this is how you do it. Or I can stand at your shoulder as your teacher, either literally or virtually through, you know, food writing or, you know, video or whatever, and I can hold your hand through making a grilled cheese, because what comes very naturally to me with, you know, almost 30 years of experience, I realize is terrifying for other people, because what if you mess up? Like, I pay an accountant because the thought of doing my own banking, I like, it makes me break out in hives. So I understand that fear when you're like, but I just spent all this money on ingredients and I don't want to mess it up, and I'm like your culinary, like, therapist. And I've been asked, you know, what would pass for really, really dumb questions, and you would never know, because I make a point of not letting you know that you've asked me a dumb question. So right. You can't. My goal is to do what my parents did, which is like, that you can ask me, you want to know when I was asked?
Yes, please.
Do scallops have feet? Yeah. So, you know, it's like, nope. Right. Now there's a part of a scallop that's called the foot that doesn't look anything like a foot, and I'm holding this thing in my hand, and it's a scallop, and it doesn't have any feet, and they were looking into my hand and said, do they have feet? Now, it would have been, it was everything I had, not to be funny, because it would right. have been so easy. But instead I said, nope, they don't. Right. It's just the name of the muscle. Right. And you peel it off because it's really tough. And my, you know, I save them and feed them my dog as dog treats because he loves them and they're not great for us.
Nice. That's yeah. a nice little tip.
There you go. That one's free.
So you teach it at the Astor Center.
Yep.
And you also have the website, The Gourmand and the Peasant. Mm-hmm. What is that about, and how is that an extension sort of your work there and personal work?
So that started while I was on my 3-hour commute. I love technology. I'm a total technology junkie, although I'm getting to a point where I don't want to learn anything new. So I have Instagram. I don't understand what to do with it. But as I started just like writing a restaurant review on a very basic WordPress, free, and it was called In the Making at the time. And suddenly people were reading it that I didn't know and commenting. I was like, well, that's interesting. Like, oh, and you could see how many people looked at your page. I was like, 20 people. 20 people looked at my page. And that gave me such a thrill. So I've made an effort to leave everything up that I've ever written, and I, including things that now make me sort of cringe, but they're all there, warts and all. And then it became more and more sophisticated, and I decided to buy the domain name. And it turned out that In The Making was owned by an aspiring hip-hop artist in the UK, and he wouldn't return my email, so I had to change the name. So The Gourmand and the Peasant was a name that my husband and I gave to a cookbook that we were going to make because we were broke. So we were going to put together like a cookbook at Kinko's and give it to people as a Christmas present. And at the time, he had gone to culinary school, and when we were dating, impressed me with like drizzled balsamic vinegar reduction. Ooh. And I'd never seen anything like that before. I was like, this guy's really hot. And I grew up on a farm, so he was the gourmand and I was the peasant, and it just sort of had a nice ring to it. And so we were going to make this cookbook, which to this day we haven't made. I still have the original index cards.
It's going to happen.
It's out there. And so thankfully, that domain name was available, and I just sort of started writing sometimes journalistically a little bit. Like, I have a piece called On Cheese that I rant about not eating full-fat cheese. It's, like, something I'm super passionate about, and it was inspired by an episode of The View. You know, being a writer and working for yourself, in my case, means a lot of daytime television consumption. I'm doing research. And there was a celebrity chef who was making a healthied-up lasagna, and they decided to substitute salmon for beef and whole wheat noodles for regular... Yeah, I know.
It gets weirder.
It gets so much weirder. And then fat-free cottage cheese. And I was like, fat? Like, first of all, there's a such thing as fat-free ricotta that I wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole. But why? Like, why? And sure enough, Sherry Shepherd said, well, why would you do that? And this celebrity chef, who hadn't been properly, like, groomed by his people, was like, because it's healthier. Oh, it's healthier. Now, millions of women, primarily women, but, you know, millions of viewers, what I would kill for that platform, just took away that highly processed cottage cheese is now healthy. And they all just ran to their local Stop and Shop and are now picking up fat-free cottage cheese. So in a self-employed rage, I went to the supermarket and I bought non-fat cottage cheese, non-fat ricotta, and the ingredients to make my own ricotta, which takes less than 5 minutes.
Right.
And I won't give away too much of the story, but you can read my scientific findings, based on calorie content and salt content and fat content and why it is that we consume, that our, you know, your great-grandmother consumed full fat cheese. And then I write like funny stuff, and some of them, now that I have a 9-month-old, my writing has gotten significantly shorter, because he's usually on my lap and has
his own agenda.
He has his own agenda. And I thought, no, look, it's going to be so easy when I have a baby. I'll just put him next to me and all right. And that isn't exactly working out.
Right. Yeah. Do you feel some of your writing moving towards sort of that mother tone? Like, are you thinking about like baby food now? And like, you know, you talked about like knives and kids. I mean, that's like an important question. Like, at what age is it okay to hand a kid a knife and say, like, let's learn to use this thing?
You know, I talk a lot about sex and drinking and drugs and, like, things that I find much funnier. And I haven't come across many writers about things about kids that, like, I don't have much to add to the conversation right now, I guess. I mean, yeah, for sure. I mean, I could absolutely tomorrow start writing about how to make your own baby food. I just pureed some prunes this morning. But I don't feel like... It's like
a separation. You want to...
Yeah.
I understand that. Fair enough.
But you know, if there's a huge... If you get feedback like, no, we want to hear her talk about her baby more, then by all means, I'll do that.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. We're talking to Chef Emily Peterson from Astor Center, founder of The Gourmand and the Peasant. And we'll be right back. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Deeper Watts by Huntronic on the heritageradionetwork.org. Keep it locked.
Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef. Pasture raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
All right, folks, we're back in the studios, Bushwick, Brooklyn, Heritage Radio Network. We're talking to Chef Emily Peterson. And Emily, we have an event. We have a relationship with Heritage Foods USA. How did that relationship start?
I met Erin at farm camp a couple of years ago up at Flying Pigs Farm. It was a program that was a collaboration between Mary Cleaver and the folks at Flying Pigs, who you can meet at the Green Market. And they took food people from New York City who wanted to learn more about where their food came from and shipped them up to Vermont, the border of New York and Vermont, for the night. And while we were there, Erin cooked the most incredible dinner. My husband still is like, I need to figure out how she did that pork. But we went to a farms making, farms that were growing pigs and making cheeses and doing all sorts of things. It culminated with slaughtering our own chicken. And I grew up on a farm, so I had to kind of sneak on the tour a little bit and also not talk too much, because it would be clear that my questions, you know, I just didn't want to, you know, because like I said before, I like running stuff, so I just had to like,
right.
But my husband didn't grow up on a farm, so I was like, yeah, you come and I'll just hide behind you. So that's how I met Erin, and then she moved down here and started doing this, and we've been sort of talking about getting together and doing something, and here we are with our grilling and swilling event.
Yeah, so that event's July 17th at the Astor Center.
Mm-hmm.
Give us a little background. What's going to happen at grilling and swilling other than grilling and swilling?
Well, that's pretty much it. It's going to be a collaboration between myself. I'm going to do the grilling component. So I've come up with four recipes to kind of give you an international palette to work with of recipes that are successfully recreated at home. So I wanted to do things that were impressive to your guests, but that were basically foolproof. And then Kimberly Koharki, Severson. Oh, she's going to kill me when she hears Kimberly Severson. She is going to do the wine component. So she's going to talk about how to choose warm weather reds to match with grilled food. And then Erin and the Heritage folks are going to talk about the importance of choosing heritage breeds and where your meat comes from and that sort of thing.
How important is that to you? I mean, is that a big focus in like heritage breeds and like where your food's coming from? And is that something you try to impress on your students?
Yes, very much so. That being said, where I live is about 10 years behind the times. So 40 miles in 10 years in terms of like, I know where my meat comes from is very novel. Like, what do you mean? How much did you spend on that chicken? So I do the best that I can. Our town's farmers market doesn't have meat, so we travel to get it. And that's sort of like what I impress upon people. It's like, it should be an effort. It shouldn't be 99 cents a pound. Like, if you understand even the smallest amount of how government subsidies are working against small farmers, you won't want to eat that anymore. I can appeal to people's conscience. I can appeal to people's wallets. I can appeal to people's sense of like real American hard work and rewarding farmers, you know, at the level that they deserve to be rewarded for doing the work that they're doing. And so we, you know, Mark and I, my husband and I, made a decision to stop buying commodity meat. And then right after that, we learned that Smithfield pork was bought by the company in China that has been on the record of really horrible food practice.
Yeah, I don't even know. That's like an entirely different
series. And I don't know. I like stopped listening because I was like, it doesn't. It's like when you hear about you know, credit card rates are going up. If you don't have credit card debt, you can tune it out because it doesn't apply to you. So for me, it was like, I don't need to learn about that pork thing because it doesn't apply to me. Like, I'm not going to buy Smithfield
right
sausages or whatever. So we raised chickens. We just got our first flock of 25 chicks. And we had chickens once before with the intention of turning them into stew chickens, except we only had four. and they got names, and then they got adorable, and we couldn't eat them, and then they got eaten by a fox, which was actually kind of a blessing in disguise.
Circle of life,
yeah,
still
happened.
Yeah, I
was like, you know what? And our neighbor was like, heartbroken. I was like, no, it's much better than having two chickens that we just are feeding and are no longer laying eggs. So I try to be very pragmatic about this flock. Like, you're all very cute when you're yellow, and now they're in their, like, adolescence, and they're ugly and terrible looking. And, you know, adolescence is cruel to everyone. But, well, you know, so that's sort of the ultimate knowing where your food came from is starting with the old chicks.
So, well, we're talking about chickens, and I'm looking at you know, some of the recipes in the menu for the event on July 17th at the Astra Center. And first one is charred oregano and lemon chicken. Can you run through some of these recipes?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. So this is one of my favorite meals, both just to eat, you know, when it's just the two of us or you know, the three of us, and then also to have for a party. It's my grandfather's recipe. Don't tell him I'm giving it out everywhere because I...
Did you hear that radio world? Yeah. Don't tell him.
Don't tell him. So you basically take a chicken, break it down into 8 or 10 serving pieces, depending on the size of the bird, and you make a coating that's, depending on how salty you like your food, I usually do 2 parts of dried oregano to 1 part kosher salt, mix that up, and then put the chicken pieces into that and coat it, like pack it on like you were breading it with just that salt and oregano mixture. Separately, you melt a stick of butter, which my dad says if a recipe calls for butter and sticks, you know it's going to be good. So a stick of butter, some white wine, and the juice of a couple of lemons. And you get a very hot grill and you char the chicken over the fire while basting it with a little bit of your butter and wine and lemon mixture. And you have to do it outside because it gets very smoky. The incense, or the oregano rather, acts like incense and infuses the chicken
with
the smoke. I think
like really emphasize like how hot you need to get
very,
the grill.
Because
a lot
hot.
Of people, when I used to teach cooking, and
yeah.
and that was the thing of like, I think it's too hot. You're like, no. We want this hotter,
right.
actually.
Fear not the heat. Yeah, especially at the grill. And, you know, you can do it over either charcoal or gas. You know, we bought a grill that we're learning to love, but I'm so used to a commercial grill where it's just, you turn it on and it's like, whoosh, the gates of hell open. Now I have this like Weber that I got off Craigslist from this little old man, and it's like, ding, ding, ding. And I got the hardware store guy to come. I was like, you sure you can't make it hotter? He's like, nope, that's it. He's like, it's 500 degrees. I'm like, I know, that sounds hot to you. So, yeah, for the purposes of this treatment of the chicken, you want it very, very hot. You baste it with a little bit of butter. You roll it around until the oregano is charred all the way around. So you want it very hot, and you want it to turn black, which also terrifies people.
Right.
You're like, no, I think it's burnt. And you're like, no. That's, you want it to look like that. In this treat, there are times when you don't want
right.
it to do that, which we'll talk about a little bit later. So you get it charred all the way around, and at this point, the chicken is still raw because it's on the bone, so you've just treated the outside. You transfer all of the meat into a pot and pour on top the remaining melted butter, wine, and lemon juice mixture. And if you use too much marinade that you feel like you don't have quite enough, you can throw in a little bit of extra wine or some water. Put on the lid, put it on a simmer for at least an hour, and then it's falling off the bone and completely done before your guests arrive. It's excellent hot. It's excellent at room temperature. It's excellent cold. It's great if you have a hangover. You can pull that drumstick out of the fridge. And
I've liked all the words
you said. I have stood in front of my refrigerator with like a drumstick on a Sunday morning.
There's no shame in that game ever.
So it's cheap and it feeds a lot of people, and I have yet to give it to someone who doesn't like it. I mean, everyone loves it, and it's like 4 or 5 ingredients, which, you know, you can't go wrong. So then if you want to talk about...
Yeah, give us maybe a couple of the other things you're going to do just so we, you know, don't run out of time.
You know what I want to talk about about the heat? One of the key things is having 2 zones on your grill. You can... Always, if you get too scared when you're cooking on really hot, if you've set up, before you put your meat down, if you've set up a cooler area where you can hold your hand over the grill for like 5 to 8 seconds, if you feel like something's burning, you can always move it to the other side. But you have to make that decision before you put your meat down.
That's at mise en place, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, set that place.
Exactly. Okay, so I just wanted to say that. Because now we've got everybody ready to turn their grills up to
right.
like hellfire.
Like, really hot.
We're going to get phone calls. Yeah. Be like, I burnt my dinner.
Yeah, I've lost my eyebrows.
I take no responsibility.
Right.
Unless I'm at your shoulder being your culinary therapist, I can only do so much. Okay. So there will be a total of four dishes. So in addition to the chicken, I'm going to do pork souvlaki's, which you marinate overnight in some red wine, and then you skewer them and put them on the grill and serve with a tzatziki sauce, which is very simple yogurt, mint, cucumber. The goal and everything was to have you being with your guests when it's time to eat. So you either like the chicken, you can have it 100% done before everybody arrives, or like the souvlaki, have it 99% done, so that all you have to do is like assume your stance at the grill, finish off what you're doing, and then sit down at the picnic and eat with your friends. Because nothing's worse than having like 20 people come to your house and then you're like chopping parsley.
Right, you
like,
say hello and then you say goodbye. Right. Yeah.
Unless you're like me and you want to be in the kitchen because you're actually kind of a social misfit. So, you know, then everybody gravitates to the kitchen anyway.
Right.
So, yeah, so we have the lemon chicken, which is like summery and lemony. I don't really know its international background. But then, so pork souvlaki's are sort of Mediterranean rim. The beef bulgogi, super thinly sliced, either boneless spare ribs or sirloin steak, marinated again overnight in soy, sesame. You can throw some miso in, some green onion. It's nothing's like written in stone. So if you don't have rice wine vinegar, you could use white wine vinegar, some other acid. And then this is a place where you want it hot, but not so hot that you can't reach in when you're flipping your meat over, because it's very thinly sliced, so it's going to cook really fast. And then you put out lettuce leaves and some Korean chili paste and some kimchi and pickles, and you have this like DIY, they're called sambap, so that's like wrapping them in the
Everybody loves that.
Everybody loves
that. Like nobody doesn't I get to put it together myself.
Yeah, exactly. And like, you know, you have people who like love condiments, and it's a good reason like get out all your hot sauces and all your weird chutneys that are half empty and be like, hey, let's try what this tastes like. And no one doesn't like to do, no one's like that. Right. And then if they are, then you need a new friend, because you can cut them. And then finally, we're going to do an all-American slider, which is ground beef with just salt and pepper on the outside. The goal when you're cooking burgers is to cook them until they're done and don't undercook them, because it's so much easier to undercook a burger than it is to overcook a burger. People think, oh, it's going to cook really fast, when in reality, not when things go awry, it's your guests have sat down, they're totally excited to eat, your burgers have come off the grill, they're charred beautifully, and you bite into it and they're like blue in the middle. And it's happened to me, it's happened to, like, it just, so I highly recommend investing in an instant read thermometer. I know on television chefs like say to like touch the meat of your thumb or the meat of your bicep, and that lies. Like I've never gotten good at it, and I cooked burgers for a living for
it's
a full
It's like
year,
you so. Have the tool
right.
that's ancient, right. essentially. Yeah.
Like, and it's science.
It costs
it's science.
$2 to buy a yep. thermometer.
Yep.
Or, you know, but like, yeah. use the tool. It's
yeah.
there.
It's yeah. there, and it and then your and then everybody will be like, oh my God, that's amazing. They're not going to say, oh, you used a thermometer. You know, that's, no one's ever going to think badly that you took the time to cook, you know.
Properly.
It's even worse with chicken. Like, oh, it was cooked on the outside, and then I took this big raw mouthful.
Yeah, nobody likes chicken sashimi.
No, nobody likes that. And then, you know, all the sort of fixins, iceberg lettuce, a slab of tomato. I don't eat out-of-season tomatoes. It's one thing that I'm a really
We're going to high-five on this one.
High-five. I'm a really big snob about, like, crunchy tomatoes. And so...
As everybody should be.
As you should be. Like, there is no excuse for that. Like, just... Eat them when they're in season and love every little bit of them. And, you know, asparagus, too. Those are my two.
Right.
I'm like. And then, so here's where I will confess that I love yellow American cheese.
And I don't think there's anything wrong with
like,
that either.
I know, like, anyone who says they don't have a secret thing is lying. So I will say mine publicly, and then you can feel better about your chamber and, like, what you hide. And, you know, I have access to the best cheese. Like, I know how to find, like, the best cheese. And what I want on a burger is a slab of yellow American.
There's something about that.
It's hydrogenated. It's, like, milky and plasticky and awesome.
And it has that look, too. You're like, yep,
yeah,
that's a burger.
Yep. And, like, I love blue cheese on a burger, but it's not the same. It, like, fancies it up in a way that sometimes I just want kind of a trashy burger. You know, and I'm already, you know, eating... Hopefully, I'm trying to get a single steer, so I know where my meat's coming from, and then I'm going to totally bastardize it. But that's what, like, if four parts out of five are, you know.
So, you know. Right.
I know, I'm single almost super. There. I have an in-season tomato. I may have even made my own roll, but I, God damn it, I'm going to have yellow American cheese
right.
on it.
So with your yellow American cheese, all natural cheeseburger, mm-hmm. yep. you know, wine's a big part of what you
yeah.
do.
Yes.
What would you pair? What wine would go well with that?
So I am a big fan of cold region red wines. So things that grow either north or south of the 40th parallel. So the Loire Valley makes incredible red wines. Germany makes incredible red wines. I would recommend drinking whatever you like. If you like big Napa Zinfandels, then by all means, like I would be the last person to stand between you and your Super Tuscan. I would recommend finding wines, particularly red wines, that have less than 13% alcohol content, because you can drink an 11 or 12% glass of red wine for the afternoon and, you know, have like a beer in the middle or a cup of lemonade or, God forbid, a glass of water. If you start with a Super Tuscan or a big Napa Zinfandel,
super sleepy.
Super sleepy, like after one glass. So start like, and you don't want all your friends to be super sleepy. And I think that people don't realize the effect that alcohol has. So when I'm choosing a wine, I've got a 4-year degree in design, which I don't use at all, but I'm very drawn to label. So I will go to a region if the wine store is divided up by region. So if I go to the Loire Valley or I go to Northern Italy and I pick up a label that I like, it doesn't necessarily have to be a grape that I like. And then I turn the bottle over and I look at the alcohol content. Like that's the first thing. If it's over 14.5%, 14.7 or 15%, I don't even want to, I don't want to read the notes. I don't want to know what Robert Parker said. I don't care because I will be drunk really fast, and then that's not fun. Right. I want to get drunk slowly. So the burger, I would get a cold weather. I'm obsessed with this wine right now called Borghiel. It's sorry, I've spaced there for a second. It's a grape from the Loire Valley. They have it at Astor Wines, which is downstairs from Astor Center, connected with the wine store. The label, it's like a little sunset abstract picnic scene, and it just makes, and it's like, drink me. Like 11% alcohol, which is basically not.
Perfect. Well, we're just about out of time. So last thing, how do we get tickets for the event mm-hmm. on July 17th?
So you go to AstorCenterNYC.com and you browse by calendar and click on the date, July 17th, and you will see Grillin' and Swillin'. And I will tell you that there are room for about 40 people, and I think there are 12 tickets left.
Get on it, folks. And then how can people follow you, connect with you on the interwebs?
On the internet. So you can go to my website, The Gourmand and the Peasant, and not judge me that I don't write very frequently. I'm also sporadically on Twitter at Chef Emily P and on Facebook / Chef Emily P. I'll tell you, when you say award-winning, there are some things that I've won that are like really legitimate and awesome. There's another one that I got, which is top 50 culinary instructors to follow on Twitter. I think I've tweeted like 12 things, and
well,
I won this.
You are definitely a winner. The best 12 tweets ever.
They are awesome, and I try to make them relevant. So when I do tweet, I try to make it relevant. So, but awesome. Find me, Gourmand and the Peasant, and then all of my links are up there. And you can.
Cool. Well, Emily, thanks so much for being on. We've been talking to Chef Emily Peterson from Astor Center, The Gourmand and the Peasant. Catch up with us at the event July 17th. Member supported. Go on there and donate. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.